Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us here on the Hearsay Culture Network for Uneven Distribution, which is my show where we talk to what I like to think of as the time travelers among us, the people who are living and experiencing aspects of our future that not all of us may be thinking about all the time. And I'm here today with my good friend, date rancher, Joan Smith. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Denise. Thank you for having me on.
So I mentioned that Joan and I go way back. We've known each other quite a while. And in fact, I'm very proud to have been one of Joan's guinea pigs when she was initially flirting with the notion of making a commercial endeavor out of growing and distributing dates. Because what Joan did back then was use some of her friends and family as guinea pigs and floated some of her would-be product by them. And they were the most delicious dates I'd ever had in my life. And I and everyone else told her, you should totally go forward and do this because this is quite an amazing product. And she did. And she's completely run with it and been incredibly successful. So what I'd love to do today here on our show is talk about the future of something we don't spend a lot of thought on, and that's the future of food and diets and farming, because that's what Joan is about these days, both farming herself and working with other farmers to source her products. And so it's just really great to have you here, Joan.
Thank you. I'm excited. Yeah, that's a lot. It's an important topic too.
It is an important topic. And it's one that we just don't, you know, it's part of our day-to-day lives. And I would say as we race forward worrying about all kinds of other things, not too many of us spend, you know, that beat, that moment to think about what foods we're eating, where they come from, are they good for us? What's going to happen with our diets over time? And I'm fascinated by the topic, and Joan and I have talked about it in the past. And so this is something that, you know, fair warning to anyone who knows me or is my friend or longtime acquaintance, as many of you already know, at some point or another, if you've not already been on one of my shows, you're going to be on one of my shows. It's because I know so many interesting people and they always are, you know, informing my insights on things. And Joan is no exception. And in fact, she is one of the preeminent people that I think of when I think about food and food health and diet. And so I'm really glad that you're here today, Joan, to first of all, you know, reflect on how the past informs the future. We're talking about dates here. The products that you've probably seen in the grocery store before, but you've probably had in your life, they're probably about as front of mind for you as something like a raisin and, you know, kind of a dried out, possibly uninteresting snack. But that is what Joan has managed to crack here and really rethought this product, this fruit that is, well, thousands of years old. I think I looked up before the show that the first dates in the world were first found in Egypt and Mesopotamia about 6,000 years BC. So to look ahead at what's happening in the food world, we're looking at something quite ancient.
Yes, this
and,
is true.
And oftentimes to know what's going to happen in the world ahead, we have to be conscious of our past and rethink our past and know our past and know what's good about it and what we want to take forward. And one thing we would definitely want to take forward is the date, and particularly dates as reimagined by Joan and her ranch, which is called Rancho Melo Duco. Joan, why don't you tell us, first of all, well, I'd kind of like to start in the middle of your story, if that's okay. And then we can backtrack a bit, because one of the really fascinating things that Joan has been able to do over time, and we're going to go into this in detail, is not only come up with an incredible product, reimagining something that is thousands of years old and making it attractive and fun and artisan and gourmet, but she's been able to market it in the most creative, imaginative ways, mostly leveraging social media to do it, but not all. One of the things you've done recently is work with Walmart and get involved in this annual competition that Walmart has that promotes smaller businesses who want to be featured in your case, all 4,500 Walmart stores nationwide in the US, any international carrying of your product? Not yet.
Not yet.
So I think of it almost like Shark Tank.
Yes. Yes.
How was that experience?
It was incredible. You know, I call it that it was just this total Hail Mary pass. And it was one of those moments where you kind of say to yourself, like, well, why not me? So you start with why me? Like, I shouldn't be doing this. It's just little me. Like, who am I? And it's like, why not me? You know, the whole purpose of their initiative is a nod to their entrepreneurial roots, as a company that was, you know, started in Arkansas. And they like to continue to support small entrepreneurs and businesses that are coming up and give them an opportunity to work with the number one retailer in the world. And it's just a great program. And in particular, this one features, is really focused on companies that are creating jobs in America. So these are products that are sourced in America, grown in America with American labor, you know, predominantly American made, which is great. So we pitched and we were selected as one of the finalists, which was about 20% of the roughly 5,000 brands that pitched. And then from there, it was, you know, it resonated. It was, we were selected. They said, we think it's great. We'd like to put you in all 4,500 stores. And I was like, okay, let's make it happen.
Yeah, I just think that's amazing. And I think that there are a couple of ways. It's great. It's wonderful that Walmart is supporting small entrepreneurs, but I definitely think there are a couple of ways that feed into our theme of the future of food. Walmart, as you said, is just such a huge seller of goods of all kinds, including food.
Mm-hmm.
But for them to be looking to smaller, you know, not mainstream, not mass produced brands for their own bottom line,
mm-hmm.
because they know their customers increasingly want those kinds of things, I think is quite interesting. And there's another aspect to this, because the product that you developed for them is a little different from your normal product, which is a high-end gourmet item that has been featured in more gift guides and recommended lists than I can imagine, including ones curated by the Wall Street Journal and Oprah's team. And I mean, it's pretty amazing what your main product has accomplished and how many people are in love with it. But for Walmart, you did something different and it reduces food waste. Tell us about that.
So with the date crop, it is natural for in particular, when we're talking about medjool dates. So the medjool date crop that we have, that we're growing here in the United States, and I can't speak to the frequency of this condition worldwide, but we have a condition that can occur on the fruit that's called puffy dates or puffy skin. And what happens is that as the fruit is in the final stages of maturation, for whatever reason, the skin sort of bubbles and separates from the flesh itself. And it's, we call them puffy dates in the industry. A typical date, if you're familiar with it, particularly in the medjools, it's the aesthetic standard is tight skin. So it's going to look like a really large shriveled raisin. That's considered sort of the aesthetic high watermark. The problem with that is that when the skin separation happens, the growers, you know, can have done everything right. So to back it up a little bit, medjools are a very labor-intensive crop. So we're growing a very labor-intensive crop in California, which is a very labor-intensive state. There are multiple stages where the fruit has to be handled, and you know, workers are in the trees on ladders up at high, you know, at height. And you can do everything right. You can thin the crop to encourage the largest fruit. You can time everything perfectly. You can put in all the right nutrients and water and turn off the water and pick at all the right time and get to the end of your crop. And the skin separates and you get this bubbling and it's considered, you know, an aesthetic fail. And the crop is immediately downgraded under kind of the traditional standards and buyers criteria. And it's a really unfortunate situation for the growers and for the processors, because through no fault of their own, they have this cosmetic, you know, effect that's considered a defect. And as someone like myself, who's an outsider kind of looking at this with a fresh set of eyes, I'm like, why is that a defect? It tastes the same. It's the exact same fruit, but it just has a, you know, a cosmetic thing. why is that being considered unsaleable almost? And there are, particularly with smaller growers who don't have the channels of distribution that larger processors do, they will combine their fruit with other small growers and bring them to these packing houses. And if they have puffy fruit, they're like, we don't want it, or we're going to pay very little for it because there just hasn't been any demand for it. And I think that's nuts. And so,
and some of it must just get flat out thrown away, right?
I mean, I guess at some point, if you have it sitting in storage long enough and you don't have a buyer, I mean, it can ultimately be potentially reprocessed into something else. But, even if you're putting it into a paste, medjool dates have a different kind of sugar activity than other dates that are typically used in paste and date byproducts. So it's not a simple thing. And you're making an additional investment in something that ultimately is maybe, for an ingredient grade. And there's not necessarily a ton of demand for, ingredient grade date byproducts. So, and you can have fruit that's big and beautiful and large and delicious and juicy, and you just can't find anyone that wants to take it. And so I just always felt like that was nuts. And I just decided that from my perspective as a consumer who's kind of new to dates, it's like, that's irrelevant to me. That's a playbook that I don't want to play by. So mm-hmm. What we've done is we've taken, what would be a surplus of fruit that, the growers and processors are choking on, and we've made it available as our, we call them our grinders. So we basically say, for those that know better, like, these are kind of the imperfect dates. They're not as pretty. They might be too small. They might have skin separation. They might have scarring, but they're all the same delicious, all the same nutritious. And we put them into a really fun little cup because we're really anti-plastic. And so one of the things that when I was thinking about how to package these and stay away from pouches, which I don't like, the ice cream cup, I was like, who doesn't love an ice cream cup? I mean, it's paper, it's cute, it has a great vibe. And so we decided to pack the ugly dates, the grinders, if you will, into these cups, and they are affordable. An otherwise rather expensive crop affordable for many people. And it solves the problem for the growers and the processors in the meantime.
That's fantastic. And it puts a product on Walmart's shelves that is, a whole food.
Yeah.
It is incredibly healthy.
Nutritious.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Talk to us about, we're talking, I want to get more into ranching and your experience as a grower and distributor of dates, but let's talk about dates as a food for a minute.
Yes.
Ancient food, been used traditionally forever, pop up a lot in salads, charcuterie boards. But one thing that you've been able to do is really think about, how else we might eat this food, what creative things we can do with it, and also really leverage the fact that it is a powerfully nutritious food. Tell us about all that.
Absolutely. So, dates are considered a superfood. They have more potassium ounce for ounce than bananas, and potassium is a really important essential nutrient. They have lots of iron. They're a good source of iron, I should say. They have a lot of fiber, which is really important in our diets. It's a form of sugar, although they are considered to be high in sugar. It's not like table sugar. It's not a sugar that our body responds adversely to. For most people, your body is able to assimilate that sugar and use it for fuel rather than go through the insulin glucose process where your body's converting it. I'm not a doctor. I can't, really speak extensively to that, but that, table sugar has, as we know, a pretty negative impact on blood sugar, which is why we're seeing an increase in diabetes, and dates are considered almost diabetic friendly. And there's people who've done studies on themselves as diabetics where they've eaten dates and then retested their blood sugar. And in many cases, they have no reaction. So it has just great potentiality there, which is also why we see things like date syrup as an alternate sweetener, because it doesn't have that negative impact on blood sugar. But it's also full of, phytonutrients and other antioxidants, of which, I'm not an expert. I just know that it's a pretty powerful fruit in terms of its nutrient capability. And it's also the only superfood that tastes like candy. And this is probably one of my most favorite statements to make about dates that I think people may not understand if they've not eaten them, is that dates taste like caramel and brown sugar. They're really delicious. They're very sweet. And, they're are so many wonderful superfoods that are now in the marketplace. I mean, that's one of the coolest things that's happening in food, is that we've now got, you know, superfoods out of South America and maca maca and goji berries and chia seeds and hemp seeds and all these amazing.
Can I back up for a second and have you explain what comprises a superfood?
I mean, a superfood, without being an expert, in my understanding of a superfood, is it's something that, you know, is, it goes above and beyond, you know, basic micro and macronutrients, that there's plant compounds inside these that have the ability to either provide an essential nutrient that's not readily available, or has some sort of antioxidant, you know, capability where it can actually help with free radicals and oxidation in the body, and is just overall healing. Dates also are a source of magnesium. I don't know the specifics of how it affects us, but there are reports and studies that show that it, you know, helps everything from kidneys to digestion to heart. You know, it's just considered a really powerful food. But back to the superfood thing, as consumers, there is no shortage of things. And every time we turn around, there's a new kale. But there are very few superfoods you can say that you would reach for in as a replacement for a Snickers bar, for example. And you can actually do that with dates, which I think makes it really cool and massively appealing to consumers who already are struggling with kind of an addiction to table sugar and all of the products that are out there, the Hostess cupcakes and all the yummy things, which I love too, but there's a lot of it and it's not great for our bodies. You know, it kind of trashes the mechanics of our inner workings. And if people could make even just one switch and maybe eat more dates and, you know, try stuffing a date with peanut butter and putting a small piece of chocolate in there and eating that instead of the processed table sugar desserts, I think it has the potential to have a huge impact, particularly on the upcoming generation. You know, you've got children that can be taught to substitute this over other things that are out there.
Right. And that's one thing I really love about your Walmart product. I kind of think of, and I don't know if you do the same, I think of your box product, which if people are watching the video of our podcast here, you can see some of Joan's packaging behind her on the shelf there. So she has a, is it a 1 pound and 2 pound size?
Yes. Yes.
Right. And then there are the little cups that get sold in Walmart. So I think of more of the box product as the adult food and the cup product is more of like, you would throw this in your kid's lunch or potentially have school systems buy it and offer it as part of a kid's lunch. Yeah. So, and I just love that, you know, this is a thing that kids could pick up and eat and feel great about eating because it's number one, healthy for them. And number two, it's delicious.
It's delicious. And if we, again, if we can start to change their little palates and, you know, sort of teach them young that there are other things that, you know, and again, raisins are great, but like they don't make date shakes out of raisins. They don't do raisin shakes. There's a reason why date shakes are a thing. I mean, they really are nature's candy. And that's a statement that, you know, you can't say about any other dried fruit out there, really. I mean, there's plenty of delicious dried fruit, but.
Right. And Joan and I are so used to having date shakes. We've grown up with them. We've lived in California all our lives, and it's sort of a treat here in California that most everyone has enjoyed at one time or another. But if you're not from our state, date shakes are amazing.
They are. And, you know, our California series, which is also concurrently being featured in about 350 Walmart stores. It's our white box is featuring, it's a nod to the history of California's date industry. And it, on the side panel, we tell a narrative explaining how, that I actually wrote, beautiful little narrative explaining how the Salton Sea area in the Coachella Valley used to be the home to over 200 date shops. And at, you know, once upon a time when dates were really popular, kind of, mid-50s, there were literally places to purchase dates and buy date shakes everywhere. And we have a recipe for an old-fashioned roadside date shake written right on the box, which is really fun. So even if you don't buy it, you can snap a photo of it and make it at home.
Yeah, definitely. If you haven't tried a date shake, if you get nothing else from this podcast, please make yourself a date shake. So let's get into that a bit. I think of you and your journey as such a back to the future journey, because so much of ranching and farming and food production these days is moving away from the small individual family owned kind of experience You know, in my own family's history, we had immigrants from Sicily who wound up in California by various circuitous routes. And some of my, you know, immediate direct ancestors were cherry ranchers. And in fact, I had a great uncle who I really wish Joan had been able to meet at one point or another, because they are kindred spirits, generations removed. Just loving cultivators of the soil and their fruit. And of course, in my family's case, and in lots of people's family's case, if they were involved in agriculture back when it was more common for things to be small and family owned, the land wound up being far more valuable for real estate. It was smack in the middle of Silicon Valley. So there goes the family farm and all of that heritage and tradition and the really incredible fruit they used to grow. I remember this from childhood quite vividly, how excellent that fruit was. And I struggle, daily and monthly in sourcing anything that approaches fruit that good. Well, Joan has gone back to those kinds of fruits where it's small and curated and the quality control is incredibly high, and that is the priority. And she's coupled it with, okay, I have this vision where I'm going to create this really high quality product. How am I going to get the word out? Well, she's gotten the word out. Tell us about your, how social media has put you in contact with people that have really helped launch your brand.
It's, you know, when I think back to 6 years ago when I started this, it was just such a perfect time to be doing it for so many reasons. Several of, you know, reasons that I think of as I reflect back on that is, you know, there were, you know, people are finding themselves more and more wanting to have a personal experience with the producers of their food. You know, the proliferation of farmers markets is a great example of that. People want to talk to the person growing their food. They want to ask questions. They want to have a relationship with the person who's, you know, producing their food if they can, and or when possible, realizing that's not practical. I mean, and I, you know, when you compare the small family farm to the large farming operations, I mean, like anything, efficiency economies of scale. I mean, that all happens, you know, that size affords advancement, efficiencies and things like that, that smaller operators, you know, it's much harder to do. But when I started, you know, I was not a heavy user of Instagram, but, you know, one of the things that's really great about Instagram is that there's a lot of engagement. And this was particularly true when I got started. If you message someone or commented, regardless of kind of the person's, you know, status or level of influence, very often you would get a response. And so I used that, and as a person who loves food, and my own excitement about these dates as a really high quality, exciting food product, I used Instagram to message editors of magazines and food magazines and celebrity chefs and, you know, just like, hey, I have this thing, like no one's doing this. Like, this is not a thing. No one's even thinking about it. I have this product and I'd love to share a sample. I'm just trying to get the word out. And I was shocked at how many people replied with like, I love dates. Like, I'd love to try your dates. Cause I didn't grow up eating dates. And it was, you know, I couldn't say that I loved them. And I, even when we were, you know, had the dates that we were producing on our ranch, it was years before I would even try one. Cause I was such a little brat and I was like, they're ugly. And, just not an adventurous eater. And, you know, although I consider myself a foodie, there are times where I can be very persnickety. And when I finally did, it was like, oh, wow. Like, okay, now I get what this is all about. So I just, you know, kind of used Instagram to crawl through, use the follower list to kind of understand who's relating to each other. And, you know, just use that as an opportunity to make introductions. And people were unbelievably responsive and kind and willing to, you know, there wasn't that degree of like having to pay for content and pay for mentions and things like that. Like it's gotten a lot, you know, it's obviously evolved into a whole business kind of model in and of itself. But back then it was really just a place to connect with people. And it was also, in terms of spreading the word, that was one thing, but it was also just a great way for people to like, here I am at my ranch and here's my dogs and here's my kids throwing mud. And here we are buying trees and planting trees. And, you know, it was just a really great way to just make it very personal. And I get so many messages. I manage our Instagram. I always have. If you're replying to someone, it is always me. I do the posts, I do the replies, I do the messages. It's all of it. And so the conversations that have come up with people and just their questions and you know, sharing information about the growing process. It's amazing, you know, how many people just had no idea. I mean, for starters, that dates even grow on a date palm. I mean, people thought they grew on like a berry bush. And they just didn't even know. And just things like that. So I really appreciate the engagement and the opportunity to build relationships with people that way.
Yeah. And I think that's really new from what we grew up with, where, you know, aside from, unless you had a family ranch that you could go to your great uncles or whatever, you probably didn't have the ability to talk to or gain any insight into people who were growing your food and who were going to take pride in it and talk to you about their process and you talk about their kids and their dogs and all of that. I mean, I think you discovered that people, that's appealing to people, that having that relationship is valuable and treasured. And, you know, your packaging is a great offshoot of this, that, you know, it's imagery of your ranch, it's dogs that you've had on the ranch, and there's a whole storytelling aspect to your relationship with the public that seems to be incredibly important to your brand and its success.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's a lot of work to maintain that kind of running dialogue, particularly because I don't live on the ranch. So it's, and as my kids get older, you know, those fun family experiences get fewer and fewer. So the kinds of content is sort of changing with the times, but you're right. And, you know, I think back to the first person that I can think of that sort of brought the ranch into our homes by way of this kind of communication was Ree Drummond with Pioneer Woman. And I was, you know, she was a great inspiration to me just as a woman and a rancher's wife. When she started her blog way back when, I was a follower and a subscriber back when she had like 10,000 subscribers on her newsletter. And she just wrote the coolest blogs and had great recipes and photos of her kids and her dogs and her horses and her cows. And it was just awesome. And it was just so cool. And from there, we've seen other, you know, people come along like Ballerina Farm in Utah, and we've got Mary at Five Mary's Farms and just a whole host of other, you know, family brands that have a presence in on social media. And I think it's wonderful. And, that, you know, the stories are just great. And I like being a part of that kind of storytelling.
Yeah. And I think it's really fascinating that, you know, that has struck a chord with so many people who, you know, the way we think about food, I think, is changing. Our appreciation for where it comes from, our wanting to know more about it and what's in it and how it's grown.
And fewer people live near farming communities. Like, there, you know, there are just, we have just vast expanses of cities and areas where there is not a farm in sight. And, you know, it's, when we grew up, the milk was delivered to the front porch. Like, we opened the door and there was the milk, and we knew the dairy that produced them. I mean, if you know, you knew where the local farm stands were. I mean, we knew the farmers, like all the communities had them, and it's just changed a lot. And people no longer have access to that. They don't, you know, everything's in a grocery store. It's highly branded. You know, it's very, you know, you just sort of don't get to know.
Well, I mean, when I was young, I never had the milk delivered to the front porch, but now I do.
Really? So right? I grew up with that the metal square with the, you know, and the glass bottles. I mean, we had that at our front porch every morning.
Well, I think it's fascinating too, that we have, well, that was definitely, you know, that dairy farmer supplying you with that, as opposed to a huge multinational conglomerate supplying you with it. Right. But the point I'm getting to here is that experience of not going to the grocery store, but having food come to you is reality for a lot of people.
Right.
It certainly was impacted by the pandemic, has shifted and, altered since then, but increasingly, whether you're door dashing or exactly one way or another, your food increasingly is coming to you. And I wonder what you think about that and how you think long-term that will affect the way we eat and the composition of our diets.
I mean, I feel like, you know, the mail order model, the delivery model is here to stay. I think it's great. I use it myself. And I notice that if I do step into a grocery store, I would say 1 out of 5 people are shopping off an app, off someone's grocery list that they've been, you know, that they've been tasked with purchasing and delivering. The other thing, I mean, in addition to having, you know, the convenience of food being delivered, I love the apps. I think that they've gotten really robust. I think that there's, you know, the ability to make selections and replacements and things like that. It's just from a pure grocery experience is awesome. But at the same time, with all of the e-commerce, all of like most of these brands that are doing ag, including meats, are mail order. You can order your grass-fed, you know, free-range beef from Montana and have it shipped to your doorstep, or, you know, from Fort Jones, or, you know, and that's true of cheeses. That's true now of produce. There's an avocado farm in Santa Barbara that handpicks these avocados, and it's everywhere. And I think that's really cool. And I think it makes it, and that's what I'm doing. That mm-hmm. was where we started out with, was at the website. And it was funny because initially it was like, well, are you going to do farmers markets? And I'm like, no, I don't, I have small children and I, mm-hmm. I go to this ranch on the weekends. Like, I'm not going to give up my weekend standing in a stall. Like my eyes were already set to a nationwide audience because I was an e-commerce shopper. I love the convenience of that. And even more so when I can find something that's like a curated artisan brand to support, like, I think that's awesome. Yeah. So, we immediately, you know, intended to go e-commerce. I never wanted to do the farmer's market. I just think it's I love the relationship part of it, but it's also, it's a big commitment of time. And, I wasn't, you know, 7 days a week, wasn't going to work for me.
Right. How do you think it shakes out sort of from a cost effectiveness standpoint? Amazon recently, you know, they used to include delivery with their grocery service. They now charge, delivery fees based on how much you spend.
Yeah.
Almost all our local grocery chains, I've noticed, have a delivery option, but they make you almost join something like Amazon Prime mm-hmm. to do away with the delivery by delivery order fees.
Yes.
So there's definitely a cost to be paid to get all this stuff so conveniently
yes.
delivered. And I'm just wondering, you know, does that just mean
to say about, I have a lot yeah. to say on that. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Where do we start? So there's a lot of things going on there. I mean, as a food brand, it, you know, it became obvious that you almost have to be in an Amazon model because consumers, you know, they have grown accustomed to the fast, overnight, quick, cheap shipping that the Amazon model has made so mainstream. And so as an e-commerce brand, you know, our actual postage cost is really high. Like, we can't even touch what Amazon can do. And so kind of trying to refine the ultimate product cost delivered, right? Knowing that that is something that people are expecting. It has always been really challenging because there's no one size fits all. I mean, a package going to New York can cost $14 and a package going to California can cost 10. Like, how do you build that in? And nobody wants to pay the 14 or the 22, you know, they don't want that. They want a flat shipping cost, which means you kind of have to, you have to build that into your product cost, which I'm not a fan of because I would rather keep it as low as possible across, like, the delivery and the, you know, like, here's your actual, but we've had to modify that. And then in an Amazon model, you know, they take a pretty good chunk of your profit. So you pay a pretty steep fee
if you're actually selling on their site.
Even if I fulfill it myself through Amazon, they're mm-hmm. going to take a giant chunk of my sale, and I'm mm-hmm. almost selling it at a wholesale rate or even less than a wholesale rate. So it is definitely a strategic, you do it strategically so that your product is available to a wider group of people because everyone else is doing it. But it's, we're not, we, you know, the processors and the makers like myself make all, you know, we make a lot less. And that can be really tricky when you're dealing with a product that's expensive to source and isn't something that's manufactured with, you know, raw ingredients that are easily procurable. I mean, we're talking about a crop that is, there's a certain amount of it. There's a certain amount of the premium fruit. Like it's just not, it cannot be, I can't go out and get more, you know, but that, so they, you know, there's that. The other issue that's really interesting with the food thing and the Amazon thing, and it's not so much with Instacart because the retailers already have the product on their store, but with Fulfilled by Amazon, we're actually sending our product out to them. They warehouse it and then they pick and fill the orders. We lose control of storage, storage length of storage, the storage conditions. I mean, there's just all kinds of things that come up. You know, they've taken in their fulfillment, they've taken our cups, which are obviously a paper cup. They put them in one of those plastic mailers, like flimsy. Of course, they're crushed. The dates pop open, the seal's off, the lid's off, the dates are in the bag.
Yeah.
And the consumer's unhappy and puts a negative review on us because the product showed up to open. And it was like, we didn't put it in the bag. It was an Amazon thing. Like why they didn't, you know, why is it not in the box? I mean, you wouldn't ship a jar of peanut butter in a glass jar in a plastic bag. So it's, you know, so managing expectations, managing the ultimate, you know, the condition of the product when it finally gets sold, you know, there is, we've had, you know, we get when, if people have issues, I'm always the one responding. And I just explain to them, like, you know, the convenience of Amazon comes with a cost. I mean, the producer, I put it into the system, but when it gets sold and how long it takes to get sold kind of is out of my hands. And there's, you know, there's a trade-off with that. And if you're, you know, if the quality, if having the freshest, most perfect date is a priority, and you want that guaranteed, you should order directly from us because it goes directly from our hands to yours. But that's one of the challenges with that. And I mean, it's easier for shelf stable products, you know, when I say shelf stable, meaning things that are, you know, they're well sealed. But again, with our anti-plastic kind of thing, our boxes, you know, we're not wrapping those in plastic. We're not using plastic. And it just, it gets a little bit tricky because, you know, the product will continue as a naturally dry fruit, dates will continue to naturally dehydrate it. That's one of the reasons why they are considered, why they were such a valuable crop thousands of years ago for people who didn't have refrigeration, right? Because the crop could come off, it would naturally dry down and it would be self-preserving. And so, you know, dates in their natural state will continue to dehydrate, but, you know, people that may get one box that's particularly soft, and then they get one that for whatever reason, maybe was in the Amazon fulfillment center a little bit too longer and it's drier, you know, it can be very upsetting. And that inconsistency is confusing for people. So, you know, it's tricky, you know, it's this delicate thing of trying to deliver a consistent experience, but knowing that convenience, if we pull our product out of that and say it's not worth it, because then you deny all these people the opportunity to get their hands on it. You know, it's tricky.
Right. And I think it's real interesting. We haven't really gone into the whys and wherefores of why you've chosen not to use plastics in your packaging and distribution, but I think it's worth exploring because obviously as a small producer, you have to make all kinds of trade-offs and decide, you know, how you're going to achieve scale and, you know, some sort of economic positive level to your bottom line, and that maybe it would be cheaper to use plastics and the food would be protected better. But you chose not to. Tell us about that.
I mean, it's really a personal choice for me. I mean, I'm just, you know, when I get on my soapbox, I just, you know, the volume of single use plastic that's out there, you know, the recycling thing, if we're to believe, you know, is sort of a myth. You know, the vast majority of that plastic is not ever really being recycled. It's basically being bundled and, you know, it goes somewhere, it doesn't go away, and it's not necessarily being converted back into a different product. And I just, to the extent that I can control one thing, that is kind of my commitment, is to not put more single use plastic into the consumer food chain. And it's just something that I feel very strongly about it. It's tough because there's a gamble with that. I mean, our product can continue to dehydrate, but you know, I just don't like, until we come up with some improvements in plastic where we can use plant-based plastics that can break down and
biodegrade. Yeah.
which we're getting closer. I can tell you that there have been in just the last 2 years, there have been from what I can tell, some really awesome and real advancements in that. And I look forward to when that product is available and we can make a switch, because then I'm all in, right?
Yeah.
But, until then, I'm not, I just can't. I'm, right. I just can't.
You know, I don't know. I'm certainly not an expert on recycling. I'm sure you're not either, but you've thought about this for your packaging at any rate. Aluminum and glass don't biodegrade either.
Right.
But yet they don't seem to be such an environmental threat. They're certainly not
right.
when it comes to the ocean. And right. I mean, maybe they are. Maybe there's aluminum and glass in the ocean that's not doing right. anybody any good right. either. But I guess we're just better at recycling those.
Yeah. I mean, well, glass is silica, it's sand, right? So mm-hmm. even if it smashes in a landfill, it's still ultimately a natural material. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it doesn't have a 20,000 year lifespan before it will degrade, you know, like plastics. Mm-hmm. Aluminum, I don't understand. I know you throw an aluminum can into the ocean, it's going to be disintegrated in like, you know, 2 weeks. I mean, but then again, is that aluminum floating around a good thing? I don't know. I think aluminum's interesting. I kind of like it, but I don't, you know, I have some reservations about, shouldn't say the safety, but you know, I'm just not sure if that's a good fit. And there isn't a lot of aluminum options out there mm-hmm. For packaging. I love the paper cups, the little poly lined cups that, you know, the ice cream pints, right? Cause they're moisture resistant. They're hot, cold. You can freeze. You're not going to have the paper disintegrating. You know, I mean, to me, it's kind of the best of both worlds. It sort of achieves what it needs to, which is it provides somewhat of a moisture barrier. We can put just a small, thin plastic, one of those tamper-proof seals that you see like on a vitamin bottle. So it's a minimum amount of plastic just to keep the lid intact. At some point, we could certainly go to one of those peel-off paper things, but that requires a machine that's like $125,000 to put those on. I mean, it's not something you can do by hand. And that's all about, you know, manufacturing capability and other things that were, you know, that are down the road. But so that's kind of where I'm, you know, that's my opinion on those things. You know, but plastic, it just takes forever to go away.
Yeah. Well, it's great. And kudos to you for not putting more of it in the environment with your business. That's incredible. Yeah. I think that's one of the things too, that, you know, people who are used to just pulling whatever product is available off a store shelf might not be thinking all that much about what packaging it comes in. They're just, you know, anxious to rip into the chips or whatever. So I do think that as people think more and more about their food and their diet, that thinking about how it's not just how it's made, but how it comes to them.
Well, it's interesting. It's sort of like that one of those like inconvenient truths. Like, it's just kind of interesting to me that there isn't more of a spotlight and more public information about where all that plastic is going, because it is no secret. Mm-hmm. There's no secret that, you know, that the vast majority of that plastic is not being recycled. And, I'm not going to profess to know what's really happening, but some of the things that I've heard, if they are true, are just incredibly disturbing. And it's like, you know, how do I contribute to something like that? And again, I buy single use plastic. I'm a consumer. I try to make good choices, but, you know, it's not that I'm not purchasing those things, but if I can control one thing, that's kind of what I choose to control. So.
Well, good. Well, again, if I can leave, I've already left you with one thing to try after the podcast, and I'm going to leave you with another. Joan already mentioned, if you've never cut into a date and spread your nut butter of choice on it and then added in a little chocolate, you've got to try that because maybe a little salt.
You got to have the pinch of salt. Yeah. The salted caramel effect. It's important.
Yeah. No, it's quite incredible. And so, I mean, those are two, you know, somewhat unconventional ways to think about eating dates. Joan's Instagram is full of other great ideas to incorporate dates. Like you go very seasonal. I think you made date soda bread around St. Patrick's Day, incorporating dates into turkey stuffing around Thanksgiving. I mean, you are just constantly thinking about how dates can be incorporated into people's diets in ways that they haven't been before, to such an extent that you've actually done a bit of global ambassadorship along these lines, back to the you know, ancestral home of the date, the Middle East. Tell us about that.
I had the most amazing opportunity. Last summer, I was approached by a group of people that were organizing the Liwa Date Festival in the United Arab Emirates. And it was going to be their first annual. There's two festivals. They have a Fresh Date Festival that's actually had just taken place last week. And then they have their Mature Date Festival, which is when the dates are fully brown. And last year was the first annual date festival in Liwa, which is a giant oasis out up against the Empty Quarter, which is that giant desert, sand dune desert that exists between Saudi Arabia and UAE. And I was invited to come along and do some cooking and to share recipes and do cooking demonstrations for this incredible event that they were organizing. They were, they'd organized all these cool activities from date auctions to olive oil competition, tasting competitions. They had chefs from all around the world. They had the executive chef and his sous chef from the Jordanian Royal Academy were there. They had President Marcon's pastry chef was there, as well as a number of other chefs. And they were just doing all kinds of different cooking demonstrations. And I was invited, believe it or not, I was the only U.S. date brand and person invited to come over and do this. It was amazing.
I think it's just so indicative of how global our food consumption and food tastes are becoming. I think it's really telling that folks in the UAE would want to get your California take on how to, you know, prepare, serve this.
Well, that was my question. I was like, but you're the ancestral, like this is your crop. Like you've been, and they said, you know, that's what's so funny is that we don't do a lot of innovation with this. It's a staple. We have the way that we consume it. It's no one's really giving much thought to it. And they had been following my Instagram for years and just recognized what a fresh perspective I was bringing to how to utilize and enjoy this fruit. And they wanted me to share that. And what was even cooler is that when I prepared the recipes that I had prepared over there, people were like, you know, the visitors at the festival that were sampling this were just like, oh my gosh, like they were mind blown. They loved it. And that was just really fun to just kind of be able to sort of give it back and let them try something. I promised them that I would try to do a camel milk date shake, but I never got my hands on any camel milk. I've been looking for it at one of the regional markets here. And I was like, I really need to do that for them. But anyway, it was a lot of fun.
Wow. We're going to stay tuned for that one. Yeah. you'll have to let me know how that comes out.
This global thing. One of the things that has occurred that has been happening since I launched on Instagram, that's really interesting, is the number of other date farmers globally who message me and they're like, I'm a date farmer in Iraq. I'm a date farmer in wherever. Lots of people from Iran message me that were sending me pictures of their crop, their date farms, wanting to chat, just wanting to connect. Like it was like they were being seen, like, oh my gosh, it's so great that you're out here talking about what we do. This is such an important crop for us. You know, it's my livelihood. And I can't tell you the number of date farmers from around the world I've connected with. And that's Instagram. That's the power of social media.
Yeah.
To connect people in ways where, you know, distance is nothing and borders don't mean anything. And we're just two people talking to each other.
Right.
With shared values and shared something that we're doing, something that we both love.
Right. You grew up in a very agricultural part of California, the Central Valley in Bakersfield, where, you know, growers there who wanted to compare notes and best practices and things would know people in their region and maybe join associations with each other. And that's how they would interact. But God, social media really adds an aspect and dimension to that we never had before. So
I've even had situations here and there where something has happened with one of my date palms that was like unusual, like some kind of a weird growth. And I would, you know, I'd be like, I don't know what this is. Why is this happening? And I would put it on the stories and say, hey, to all my fellow date farmers out there, you know, does anybody know what this is? And I've had lots of input and feedback from people, that I solicited and unsolicited, offering suggestions as to how to improve, and vice versa. People have come to me and said, do you have any suggestions on how to address that? So it's very interesting. I think the more we can connect as people, I think the better we are, you know.
Yeah.
There's so much upside to that.
The other globalization piece that I think is so fascinating when it comes to food and our diets is how much more variety of food we eat now than and our kids eat now. Incredible. Than ever was the case when I was young. You know, when I was young, there would be meat and potatoes and cottage cheese and, you know, whatever dishes family would bring to the potluck kind of thing. And now, you know, I mean, our kids are of similar age, and the variety of global foods our children not only have sampled, but have made staple parts of their diets, right, is absolutely worthy of note and remark, because that's a huge shift from when I was young and when you were young. And I don't think it's unique to California. It may be unique to certain socioeconomic abilities and privilege, to be sure. But at the same time, a lot of the global foods that we're exposed to are not, you know, super high-end gourmet artisan things. They're the traditional foods that people have brought with them when they have emigrated to the United States and continue to cook. And then, you know, as part of their livelihood, may make available to others. I've never heard of a birria taco, birria, until about maybe 2 years ago. And now they are everywhere. And this is just, you know, a very localized food in a certain part of Mexico that has become incredibly popular, at least where we live. Right. When I visit Mexico now, I see them everywhere in Mexico now too. Like, it's definitely taken on legs from its little local, yes, environment. And I think, you know, all of this is a way of asking a roundabout question about diversity in our diets and consuming things that might not be part of our own local cultures, and what you think that means for the future of both, you know, health and diet for humanity.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great time to be in food. I think that, you know, that we've been saying for decades, it's a global economy. And I think the fact that food is now everywhere, it really speaks to that, the globalness of that. I mean, there just is not, there is no longer really a thing where you can't get anything because it's, you know, native to some other region that, you know, is not accessible. I think it's interesting too, because we continue to kind of discover new, superfoods, foods that have really potent, you know, plant properties. I think that's very interesting. You know, the specialty produce distributors like Melissa's they've done an amazing job of just making so many interesting fruits and spices and, you know, unique kinds of things, chilies and whatnot available. I think it's here to stay.
And there is so much more Asian food in the normal run-of-the-mill Caucasian U.S. diet, yes, any citizen of the U.S. diet, than there ever used to be. And yes, it's so good. And like, the more, you know, there's so much to explore there. Yes. Obviously, every region, yes, of China, every region of Japan, Vietnam, yeah, Thailand, the food is so incredible. Absolutely. And India, of course. And just, you know, and again, there's a lot more emphasis on different kinds of foods in those cultures than we're used to in the U.S. There's maybe more seafood or more vegetables or so, I mean, that's got to be all to the good, right? That people are, absolutely, broadening their, absolutely, horizons.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the more adventurous people can be with food and the more they can expand their palate, I think it produces a greater appreciation. And I think that, I mean, it's certainly a great way to kind of get off the, you know, the manufactured food goods, you know, the more you can kind of experience different cuisines and, you know, those kinds of things. You know, those, the whole foods and the dishes that are made with those whole foods that are, you know, coming from different cuisines and regions, you know, it's, that's all for good because it invites exploration, it invites curiosity, and, you know, discovery. So.
Right. There's another social media piece that we haven't really talked about yet that I think is super important to the way people think about food, what foods they decide they're going to consume and prepare. And that is things like YouTube and TikTok and the video aspects of social media that, you know, take folks that might not be as brave or adventurous and step-by-step show you, you know, here's where you can source the ingredients. Here's how you prepare them. And you watch it over and over again until you can stop it where you need to, until you're done shopping and then go on to the next step. And it's making chefs out of people who might not otherwise be chefs.
Absolutely.
And making them creative.
Well, and people eat with their eyes. So if you, if you're someone who can create really good video content, that was something that that's enticing, like people are going to run out and buy that. And that was, you know, one of the toughest sells that I have with dates is that it's just, it's the household consumption rate is really low overall in the United States. I mean, I think the estimates are somewhere around 5%. You know, I think that there's a ton of growth potential there because, you know, it's not just another kale. Like this actually tastes really good. Like give it a chance. And I can 100% guarantee, you know, for 95% of the people, it will totally change their perceptions of dates. And moreover, I am convinced that, you know, with things like, I call it kind of the gateway drug, which is like that Snickers date where you put the little peanut butter in it and the optional chocolate, you know, that's a snack that people try and they are, they will buy it again. It's not a one, it's not a one and done. It's like, oh yeah, I could eat this on the regular. And, you know, and you've got, that's the benefit of things like TikTok is that you can kind of get those viral discoveries. And as we were, since we've done our Walmart launch, I've been trying to kind of capture more of that viral audience with the peanut butter stuffed date, because I have shared with different people I've talked to, it's sort of like the fruit roll up with ice cream. Like it has that, it's that impactful, you know, when they were doing the fruit roll ups and you put the ice cream and then you eat it and it would like shatter and it was, everyone's like, oh my God, that's so good. I mean, it has that kind of impact for people to like all go out and try it just to try it, to see what the buzz is about. But I think that dates are delicious enough that it will stay, that it has the potential for people to continue to buy. And then that's where my job and my, what I enjoy doing, which is coming along and saying, okay, now that you've discovered that dates actually taste really great, look at all these other ways you can enjoy it. Stuff it with ice cream. You know, there's a date bark, a viral date bark going around. We've done a date turtle where you smash a date, layer the peanuts, drizzle the chocolate, and you've got essentially like a caramel turtle, but without caramel. And, you know, that's kind of my vision, is to just really help, you know, once they've got the box of dates and they're like, now what do I do with them besides enjoying them? Here's all the other ways you can, and you know, incorporate them.
So I know you're a person who likes data and benchmarks and analytics and things. Looking at your Instagram posts and your TikToks that you post, is there one that really stands out to you, something that went viral or just got a lot of engagement?
I think the one that historically has, you know, there are a few. The one that comes to mind immediately is the one where I show the progression of the maturation of the fruit. And that just, again, is one of those things that people wouldn't know. And it's also a great, for me, it's informing people about what to expect, right? You know, if you open a date and there's black mold, right? This is a naturally occurring, you know, thing that occurs on the tree. Nothing can be done about it. It's very hard to find, but people get it. And they're like, oh my God, there was black mold. They think it's a reflection on, you know, the practices. And it's like, no, it's just, it comes off the tree like that. Explaining why they might find insects, you know, again, a natural, they call them natural and unavoidable crop defects. Like they happen. And, you know, to that end, that progression showing the maturity progression of the fruit from yellow to brown also explains why you might get a box of dates where the fruit's a little drier. And it's like, it is a living, breathing fruit that continues to naturally dehydrate. That is its normal state. And so I feel like that was a really informative post because it shows people the progression of the fruit. And it also shows how it can go from being softer to like much harder. And it's doing exactly what it's supposed to. But a lot of times the informative posts like that are the ones that get the biggest traffic. I mean, some of the food ones really hit, but you know, some of those kind of behind the scenes kind of things, I feel like are really popular.
Back to your initial point that people seem to really want to know more about their food and where it's coming from and who's behind it. Do you have any thoughts on plant-based diets at all? And I'm sure there are plenty of people who love your product because they are going down that path and it's such a delicious thing for them to add to their diets. My own take on diet is, you know, I mean, I have to say I'm not super conscious of the nutritional value of everything that I eat, but I'm trying to be better. I really am. I mean, my doctor tells me to be better. I know I feel better when I pay more attention to these kinds of things. And, you know, on the sort of further down that spectrum from someone like me, who's just trying to be better, are people who are being really, really conscientious about their diets and have chosen for health or other reasons just to cut out meat altogether. Any thoughts about where that's headed?
I mean, I feel like that trend is probably here to stay. I think there's, I feel like there's a multitude of reasons why that's not going away. I think that there's plenty of science behind the health benefits of a plant-based diet. You know, there's one of the, you know, kind of fathers of that movement, you know, has says, you know, eat mostly plants and vegetables and a little bit of meat, you know, and then obviously there's folks that don't do any of the animal products at all. And, you know, potentially too, you know, I don't, carbon footprints and sustainability and things like that. You know, there's, you know, having something that's regenerative where you can harvest a crop and, particularly in the case of a fruit tree, it's going to produce a crop, you know, in the case of dates, every bit of 50 years, you know, so you're able to constantly, you know, kind of regenerate that. I think it's here to stay. I don't, you know, I don't know that enough to say whether cow farts is, you know, bad. You know, I mean, I think there's trade-offs to all those things. And, you know, we forget that there's machinery being operated to harvest these, you know, there's just a lot of things. There's energy that's being used to lift, you know, to power the pumps and the, you know, there's a lot going on. And I don't know that we all have enough information to, you know, in terms of like that kind of a value judgment, I guess, but you know, but health benefits. Yeah. I mean, I don't think you can argue with that. Which is again, for me, the dates, you know, recognizing that at least in America, we would appear to have a problem with our sugar consumption, based on the, you know, kind of the degree of health related effects that we're seeing, like diabetes and heart disease and things like that, that are kind of attributed to, you know, maybe having too much sugar in our diets. You know, it certainly would be better to supplement a whole fruit that tastes almost as good, with some of those sugary treats whenever possible.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of one of those making one choice, where you can, or doing what makes sense.
Right. Exactly. Well, Joan, I am so thrilled that you've taken the time to be with us today and to sit down with me to think about diets and food and farming and where this is all headed. And I just so appreciate you and all you do, and hope folks have really enjoyed your thoughts and insights.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining us on this episode of Uneven Distribution here at the Hearsay Culture Network. We put out the show twice a month and we look at the future of things. So if you have further ideas, things that you'd like us to go deeper and look at what may be headed your way, find some folks who are time traveling and living that experience now, please email me, Denise@hearsayculture.com. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to get your feedback on this show and any others. And just hope you'll keep coming back and joining us and enjoying the insights of our fabulous guests like Joan today. Thanks so much, Joan. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
All right. So we'll stop the recording.
Okay. And then we'll do our bonus questions, right?
And we'll do some bonus questions. So we're going to...
How'd that go? Was that okay?
I think it was great. Yeah, I was fascinated.
Cool.